Questions? So we'll start today chapter 23, which deals with galaxies. You should have a handout like this that describes the history of the process of doing the galaxy. So just as we spent a noticeable amount of time talking about how people figured out that the sun was the center of our solar system, we're going to spend a noticeable amount of time thinking about how people figured out that how the galaxy worked and how the universe is put together out of multiple galaxies. You might remember for the solar system, it's not exactly an obvious statement, right? So way back in Greek times, Aristarchus said, the sun's the center of the solar system, but there wasn't any data to support it. And Copernicus famously wrote about the sun being the center of the solar system, but his data didn't actually support his hypothesis. So we owe a lot of it to Tycho, who made the careful observations, and to Kepler, who showed that the only way you could make those observations work was with ellipses that were that had a focus point on the sun, and with Galileo, who kind of cleared up the objections that people had based on his not understanding, but just see. I mean, Jupiter works, so it's got to be okay for the sun. And finally, Newton showing that you could get really precise calculations if you, again, followed his whole system of the universe. So we want to do kind of the same thing for the galaxy. How do we figure this all out? Basically in the 1800s. Well, and a good bit into the 1900s. But last time we were finishing up stuff that had to do with black holes, things like that. So the basic idea is that Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is a replacement theory for Newton's theory of gravity, because his special theory of relativity showed that ideas of space and time that Newton had used had to be false. So it was pretty clear after 1905 that things had to change. In 1915, he came up with his general theory of relativity, which approximately speaking says that matter and energy curves space, and space, given that it's curved, tells matter how to move. And the idea is that matter is actually moving on geodesics. So even what seems to be a curved path, say for the planet Mercury, is really, properly speaking, a geodesic, the shortest possible distance between two points, which is to say a straight line, so defined. So this idea of curved space is confusing, and basically because it's totally unobservable. The only way we would actually observe curved space would be by seeing that the theorems that you learned about in high school that Euclid came up with actually don't apply to the real universe. So if you made a big triangle and you found that the angles didn't add up to 180 degrees, that would be a sign that the space doesn't follow Euclidean geometry and hence has to be curved. If the circumference of big circles wasn't 2 pi r, then that would be evidence that the universe was curved. So these pictures that we have of curved space have nothing to do with real measurements. So the kind of usual funnel shape that you see associated with black holes, wherever that is, that isn't something that you would physically observe. What you would observe is that you can't put together ideas of, I mean, there it is in hard copy, you can't put together ideas of circumference without using a dimension that you can't occur. So if you started to make circles around a black hole, you would find that when you went in closer to the black hole, the circumference wouldn't change in the way that Euclid declared, right? So you go in a meter, you would expect the circumference to change by 2 pi meters, and it doesn't. It's as if you didn't go in as far as you thought, that the meter that you went was kind of partially in another direction. So we can't experience this direction. We can just kind of calculate its existence based on the failure of Euclid's geometry. Okay, so this leads to really odd sort of phenomena, and these things are particularly clear for the problem of falling into a black hole, I claimed that the result is pretty surprising, that in fact you'll never see something fall into a black hole. It takes, from the outside, it takes forever to fall into a black hole. basically because clocks run slow when you're close to the event horizon, and distances get stretched when you're close to the event horizon. So as a result, if you drop a piece of chalk into a black hole, it'll seem to hover just above the event horizon, approximately speaking, forever, for the history of the universe. It'll never actually cross the event horizon as viewed from the outside. If you were to ride along with a piece of chalk, no problem. In a very few number of seconds, you would go through the event horizon. You wouldn't see anything special happening there. And you'd end up very quickly at r equals zero, along with all the rest of the matter that makes up the black hole. So I don't know, it seems incredible that you can have these sort of disagreements between two observers. Somebody says it takes a finite amount of time, somebody says it takes an infinite amount of time, but it is all possible. It's also possible to have, for example, time travel in the future. All you have to do is crank somebody down a rope close to a black hole and his clock will run slow. And after what seems like a century to you, you can crank him up out of the black hole, not past the event horizon, of course, crank him up closer to normal sorts of space, and then he would have seemed to have aged a very small amount. So time travel to the future is quite possible. You don't even need a black hole. You just need high speeds, as special relativity showed. So as much as anything else, because it was in the news, I wrote down some numbers that have just come out about what's probably the best black hole candidate, Cygnus X1. It's seems to be an ordinary ninth magnitude star in the constellation Cygnus, but it's a source of X-rays, and typically stars aren't sources of X-rays. And what we figured out is what's going on there is we have a supergiant O star, a blue star. Material, this star is overfilling its Roche lobe. Material is falling onto some compact object. We can't see the compact object, we just see the X-rays that are being produced as the material spirals down into onto the compact object. But we can weigh that object because it's a binary system, and it turns out to weigh 15 times the mass of the sun. And we know that neutron stars can't exist at more than 3 times the mass of the sun. So either there's a new sort of compact object that we don't know about, or this has to be the only thing that we know of that's more compact than a neutron star, namely a black hole. The usual sorts of things apply. When we have accretion disks, we often have bipolar jets, and we see this also in Cygnus X1. These things are orbiting around each other at a pretty high rate of speed, having an orbital period of just about 5 days. The black hole spinning fast, comparable to the fastest spinning neutron stars, 800 revolutions per second. And the whole shebang is 6,000 light years away, which may sound like a big distance, but it's small change in our galaxy. In the contrast of looking ahead to ways that we find distances, I comment that this distance was actually found using a method we haven't much talked about. It was a parallax method, but not using an optical telescope, using a radio telescope. So remember that radio telescopes have much better resolution than optical telescopes, so you can measure that very small angular displacement as the Earth goes around the sun, the apparent change in location of Cygnus X1. Questions on any of that? So we also then talked, you can see that it was on the last exam, but not on your exam, the idea of finding distances. It's going to play a big role in our discussion of the shape of the galaxy. And the upshot of this is that the distance modulus is a great way of finding distances. If you know the difference between the apparent magnitude and the absolute magnitude, then you can look up the mathematical relationship that relates the distance modulus to the distance. And apparent magnitude is easy to measure, right? That's the sort of thing that was done long ago by Hipparchus. So the hard part is somehow knowing the absolute magnitude, finding some measurable property of the star that tells you the wattage of that star, the actual luminosity of that star. Because if you know how bright something seems to be and you know how the wattage that it's actually producing, you can use the 1 over r squared law to get the distance. Assuming no dust, right? Assuming that space is transparent. So we talked about a couple of methods to do that. We can look at the spectral type of main sequence stars. So we can measure, in this case, the color of a star, and we can go up and we can get the absolute magnitude of that star, and we can get the distance to that star. This isn't a tremendously accurate way because there's some range of possibility for the absolute magnitude. We do better if we have an open cluster, and then we can average over lots of stars, 1,000 different stars, and get the better precision that you get with averaging. That's called main sequence fitting. And notice that we have to distinguish the giant stars from the main sequence stars, which we can do spectroscopically, right? These guys have the broad lines, these guys have the narrow lines. And confusingly, this is called the spectroscopic parallax. This word parallax then referring to any old distance measurement. We've long talked about Cepheid variable stars. These are stars which pulse. And from the time it takes for them to complete a pulse, we can read over what the absolute magnitude is and get the distance. So these are cases where we have a calibration that relates some measurable property like the period to the corresponding absolute magnitude. There are stars that have more or less a constant absolute magnitude. Those things are called standard candles, and R.R. Leary stars are an example of that. Type 1a supernovas are an example of that. So, I mean, for example, the supernova that I've been studying in M101, it had an apparent magnitude of about 10, and it has an absolute magnitude as a standard candle of about -19.3. So roughly speaking, the distance modulus to M101 is going to be 29.3. And I can go to my chart and I can figure out what that distance corresponds to in light years. Turns out it's about 20 million light years away. And mostly just for the purpose of your notes, I said that there's another method that we'll talk about in the future called the Tully-Fisher method, which is used at even larger distance scales. Questions about distance measurements? Okay, so the plan then is to talk about our galaxy. And kind of my plan is to talk about the facts, whatever that means, and then to talk about how we discovered those facts, what the history of discovering those facts is, and of course, recognizing that the facts depend on what century you're in, which, you know, maybe the facts that I'm telling you today are not going to be the final word. Okay, so our galaxy is flat. Right? So it has, if we were to look at it face on, there would be spiral arms like that. If we were to look at it on the side, you'd just see a line that is a disk. Right? So this is the disk of our galaxy. And the kind of first thing that you're going to write about is what's the diameter of this disk. And if you look in books, typically they'll say about 100,000 light years. If you look at our book, it'll give a number that's more like 150,000 light years. And I don't care which number you use. I mean, the facts are there isn't a definite edge to our disk the way there's a definite edge to this Frisbee. Okay, and the other thing you'd be interested in is how thick the disk is. And it turns out that the disk actually has the aspect ratio of a CD. So it's that, relatively speaking, flat compared to a disk. So it has a thickness, and this is, again, there isn't a definite object there, right? So it doesn't have a definite thickness, but if you want a number, a round number, maybe 1,000 light years or so. Now if you look in kind of greater detail, it's not exactly circularly symmetric. The central area of our galaxy, and this is a discovery of just the last 10 years or so, isn't exactly a circle, it's what's called a bar. Right, so we have kind of a central bar, an ellipsoid, and then we have spiral arms that are coming out of it. So technically speaking, it's a barred spiral galaxy. There are also normal so-called normal spiral galaxies in which we have a nice circular region at the center. So this is what kind of a normal galaxy would look like. If you look at it, they're claiming that our galaxy is a normal galaxy. But as I say, recent discoveries are that, and I believe, that our galaxy actually has a bar at its center. Now, you might wonder kind of why that sort of uncertainty could be resolved in just the last decade or so. So here's kind of a big scale picture of the Milky Way. And so this is the band of light we see in the sky. It goes through the Northern Cross, goes by Altair, kind of goes across the sky. But you can see that there are big patches where there seems not to be much stuff. So kind of the question is, how do we interpret this absence of stars? And there's a history to that, which we'll get to eventually, but the facts are that what's happening here is there's lots of obscuring dust. So we can't see very far in our galaxy because there's lots of dust that's confined to the disk. And this is one of the confusing things. The center of our galaxy is, I don't know, roughly speaking, 25,000 light years away. And we can't see it, at least not with an optical telescope. But I've just been telling you, I've been looking at a supernova that's 1,000 times further away, 20 million light years away. You know, so how is it that I can see something that's 20 million light years away, but I can't see something that is just 20,000 light years away? And the answer is that the dust is patchy. The dust is, so if here's our galaxy, the dust is really confined to the disk. So we have no problem seeing something that's in that direction because space as a whole seems to be dust-free. The dust is all in exactly direction that makes it problematic to see anything that's in our galaxy. So it's kind of like living in a fog. With a visible light telescope, you know, we can maybe see that much of our galaxy. And so it takes a lot of work in order to figure out that there's all of this galaxy behind this fog that makes us being a spiral galaxy. If we look at the kind of distribution of standard objects, in lab we've looked at open clusters like the Pleiades. So this is a graph of the sky in which we've made the, instead of making the celestial equator be the center of our graph, we've made the Milky Way be the center of our graph. So the Milky Way goes right through here, and each dot represents an open cluster. So you can see from this that the open clusters have a strong probability of being in the disk. And that should come as no surprise, right? Open clusters are formed from giant molecular clouds, which are the things that have the dust. So kind of no surprise, we get new star formation and open clusters in the disk and not away from the disk, right, where there isn't much stuff. Okay, so I've just convinced you that we should look for clusters in the disk. Well, we've also looked at globular clusters. So here's the location of globular clusters. They actually avoid the disk, right? We don't see them there. We see them above and below. We don't see them 180 degrees from the galactic center. Incidentally, the center of our galaxy is towards the constellation Sagittarius. We don't see them 180 degrees from the constellation Sagittarius. We see them kind of in a bee swarm that is surrounding Sagittarius, but we don't actually see them right in the disk. Why don't we see them right in the disk? It turns out they're distant objects, and if there was one, and there are some that are right in that direction, but we can't see them through the dust. Right? So this apparent avoidance of the disk is, again, it's the usual story. It has to do with dust. And if we were to look at this guy, there'd be a lot less dust looking at that guy than there would be looking at guys that are closer and closer to the plane of the disk of our galaxy. Okay. So here's another attempt to kind of put together the picture. And in order to make this sort of picture, we actually have to have that third dimension. We have to have distances, right? These were just angles in the sky that we were looking at a moment ago. But here we have the sun right there, and we have plotted the distances to various objects. So to open clusters as dots, to OB associations. I haven't really talked about them so much. They're just young open clusters that have lots of OB stars, and to H2 regions like the Orion Nebula. And you can see that these things tend to line up in various lines. It's not perfect. We've got stuff between these concentrations, but this is a kind of an attempt to see the spiral arms given that we're in amongst all of this dust, which makes it hard to see very far at all. So we can kind of just barely see to the next spiral arm in and out from our location. And what we for sure can't see, we can't follow this spiral arm any large distance around to see where it connects up to. So for example, this picture I've drawn has assumed that there are two spiral arms, right? So that if we could see the spiral arm that was 2N, it would be the same spiral arm as ours. But we can't match up that with any sort of precision because we can only kind of see this distance. So there's actually an argument about whether our spiral galaxy has four arms or two arms. I can't remember what our book says. I believe two arms, incidentally. But you know, it's an unknown because we can't actually see very well. So I guess here's a picture that is claiming that there are four spiral arms. Incidentally, there are also partial arms kind of like that. We see those in other galaxies, so we're pretty sure that they're also going to be present in our galaxy. And I also want to think about kind of this picture, which we'll come back to today or tomorrow. So remember, this was the picture of the proper motions of stars near the sun. So approximately speaking, we see kind of a random possibility, right? Stars are going pretty much every old way with some sort of characteristic velocity, but there are a handful of stars that are going very, very fast by the sun. Okay, mostly random speeds. If we look at this in greater detail, we find that the stars that seem to have those more or less random speeds are stars like the sun that have been polluted with metals, right? The population 1 type stars. Stars that have been created in the last 10 billion years as opposed to being very old stars. And the reason they seem to be going in and out is they have orbits around the center of our galaxy that are slightly eccentric compared to our orbit, so sometimes they're getting closer to us, sometimes they're getting further away. But we're all moving together at high speed, maybe 200 kilometers a second, around the center of our galaxy, which is again in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. The stars that seem to be moving fast have these very elongated orbits that aren't part of the rotation. So they only seem to be moving fast because we're going fast that way. So we're whizzing by them at 200 kilometers per second. So they seem to be going fast, 200 kilometers per second in the other direction. But in fact, they have these very elongated orbits, slow orbits that don't partake in the general rotation of the disk. Okay, so if we go back to this kind of picture of the of our galaxy, you know, what would this snapshot look like 100 million years in the future? How do these patterns change? So the first thing that happens is, and it's a little bit confusing, is that this pattern is rotating this way, kind of the way it looks like it's rotating. But that's kind of not how it works for the individual stars. The stars are actually orbiting faster than the pattern is changing. So the usual analogy that is made is to think about, you know, some slow-moving vehicle on I-94. There'll be a traffic jam behind that slow-moving vehicle, and you look at that jam, 20 minutes in the future, there's still going to be a jam. But the cars that are making up that jam are constantly changing, right? They come in at the back and they work their way through that jam and they come out the front. So the particles that make up this spiral arm, so currently the sun is not actually in the Orion local arm, it's a little bit outside of it. In the future, it'll move through the arm and it'll be in front of the arm. So the individual particles are actually rotating faster than the pattern that is making up these spiral arms. So it would take the sun about 200 million years to make one full cycle of the of our disk. Some kind of vocabulary words. So we've already talked about spiral arms, which are these things. This flat area, that's the disk. The area above and below the disk, that's the halo. So here we have kind of a standard picture. We have the globular clusters more or less spherically distributed in the halo around the center of our galaxy. The sun being halfway, one-third of the way out from the nuclear bulge. And if you look at these pictures, the disk isn't all the way flat. In the area of the nucleus, it bulges out a noticeable amount. Okay, questions about kind of the facts? So how did people discover these facts? I mean, what's the history of how this thing was all worked out? Well, there's probably two important themes in this kind of timeline that we have. So one theme has to do with nebula. So this word nebula goes way back and it means just a fuzzy patch in the sky. And the fundamental issue is, are nebula really fuzzy? That is to say, are they really made out of gas? Or are nebula really just lots of stars put close together? And the answer is going to be yes, right? Some of both, right? Which is, of course, a confusing answer. The other kind of big piece of the puzzle is the dust. So people found no evidence for absorption of sunlight in the solar system, and they pretty naturally assumed that space was perfectly transparent. And it ain't so. But it ain't so in an unhappy way. Right? If there were some uniform amount of dust, it would have been pretty easy to detect. But it's not that way. Right? In that direction, there may be dust, and so the astronomer may write a paper saying there's lots of dust. Another astronomer looks in that direction and says there's no dust. So we have conflict and confusion. Okay, so dust, perennial problem for astronomy, still a problem today because it's patchy. If there were a number for dust, we'd do a lot better. Okay, so you can see kind of the overall structure of this document. We have early history here, most importantly through the 1800s for the history of astronomy. Really, professional astronomy was really only starting at the end of the 1800s. And what we have here is a kind of a snapshot for where astronomy was roughly at 1900. Again, not precisely that way. In the center, we have four research programs, seemingly unconnected ideas about how astronomers went around measuring various properties and what they're going to come up with. And here at the bottom, we have kind of the story of dust. And at the very end, we have kind of the next chapter in our book, which has to do with once we've realized that we live in a universe of galaxies, that our galaxy isn't the whole story, then we're interested in the structure of the universe as a whole. And that is opened up by Hubble circa 1929. Okay, so let's start. So, you know, long ago we talked about Galileo. I just talked about him, I guess, a moment ago in the context for figuring out that things weren't made of the quintessence, right? There were sunspots. Moons could hang on to planets, even though it wasn't clear exactly how, right? Jupiter's that case. Venus, at least, had to be going around the sun because it showed phases, right? So those are all pieces that had to do with the old story about the sun being the center of the universe. But up here at top, we've got what was kind of small potatoes to us at the time, and that is that for millennia, people had looked at the sky and seen this band of light that we call the Milky Way and wondered what it was. And what Galileo did is he aimed his telescope at the Milky Way and he said, well, what I see when I aim my telescope at the Milky Way is zillions of stars. So this nebula seems to be resolvable into lots of individual stars. Lots of stars in those sorts of directions. Okay, so then we've got Isaac Newton, who wrote down a theory of how gravity works and how mechanics works that was going to last as the theory until 1915 and Einstein, and still works today as a theory that is 99.999% accurate, right? So if you want to go to Mars, you don't need anything beyond what Newton said. It's an excellent working approximation for the truth. Okay, so Immanuel Kant is a name that I hope you know in another context, right? He's, one of the very few most famous philosophers. But he also did some work in astronomy. And he came up with an explanation for what's going on with the Milky Way. So again, the phenomena that we have for the Milky Way is when we look in the sky, we see this band of light. And his explanation was that we live in what he called a grindstone universe. So think about the shape of a grindstone, right? It's something that is, you know, disc-shaped, relatively thick, you know, not nearly so thin as the CD, but relatively thick with a radius. And he said the reason we see this band of light in the sky, which Galileo tells us are lots of stars, is if we look up above that disc, you know, there aren't many stars in that direction. If we look in the plane of the disc, we see lots of stars. And since the Milky Way seems to be, you know, roughly speaking, as dense here as it is there, the idea kind of behind this idea was that maybe the solar system isn't the center of this grindstone, but it's probably at least close to the center. But already people had seen these clouds in the sky, some of which could not then be resolved with telescopes. Right? So are they gaseous things that are close, or are they things that are like our grindstone but are very far away? And he postulated, again, it's not data that he was saying. He was saying that those things may also be things that are co-equal with our grindstone. So Immanuel Kant had it all right, right? These, more or less, right? These are the ideas that are going to turn out in the end to be correct. But having the right ideas, while it's important, is good. It's nice to have the data to support them. And in particular, we know that we're not the center of our galaxy, right? That had to be resolved. So one thing that makes life a lot easier for astronomy is space is a big place. And if you just kind of randomly aim your telescope, you're not going to discover things. So it's very helpful to have catalogs of interesting objects. And Messier kind of published the first and very useful catalog of objects. For him, it wasn't a catalog of useful objects. It was a catalog of objects that weren't interesting. He was interested in comets, and these were things that he had been confused about. He thought they were comets for a while, but then they didn't turn out to be comets. So rather than repeating that mistake time after time after time, he listed the location of these fuzzy balls that might be mistaken for comets. And of course, we know that those fuzzy balls actually turned out to be things like open clusters and galaxies and globular clusters, things that lots of people, including me, think are more interesting than comets. William Herschel. So William Herschel was fundamentally a musician, but he started to make some observations, and he discovered a planet. He discovered the planet Uranus and therefore became kind of famous as an astronomer. And in some sense, he became the first professional astronomer when he received a grant from the King of England to pursue those studies as opposed to his musical studies. So as kind of the first professional astronomer, he really went out of his way to map in detail and locate lots of interesting objects in the sky, right? So Galileo did a quick exploratory process looking at what he could see with the telescope. Herschel really went, you know, every night, although England is cloudy, went out every night possible in order to look at data. So the first thing on this list is this idea of star gauging, and it's going to occur again and again and again, and it actually goes back to the ideas of Kant. So the idea is that if we live in kind of a grindstone universe, we can figure out how far it is to the boundary of that grindstone by counting the stars. If we look in a direction that there are relatively few stars, that means that the boundary of the grindstone must be relatively close. So again, the kind of the picture you have is this sort of thing. Maybe here's the sun. We look in this direction, we don't see so many stars. We look in that direction, we see lots of stars. And we can use this as a way then of kind of mapping out our galaxy. So he called this star gauging because literally what he did is he just counted the number of stars he could see in his telescope field of view. And then he plotted that out as a function of various directions. So he would come to the conclusion that a spot like this must be relatively close to the boundary of our grindstone. And so it wasn't quite so literally grindstone because it had holes in it, right? Because in this particular direction, there weren't very many stars, where in neighboring directions, there were lots of stars. Okay, so this is a mistake. It's probably a mistake that he knew he could be making, right? That absence of stars could be due to obscuring material. But generally speaking, people didn't believe in obscuring material at this time. The solar system, at least, seems to be transparent, so people assume that space as a whole was going to be transparent. Okay, so, you know, that's what you got, right? You can't measure distances to those particular stars, so you can find the edge just by counting those stars. Planetary nebula. So you know what planetary nebula are. Right, so these are these often ring-shaped cloudy areas with a very hot star in the center. Right, and the story of planetary nebulas is this is the end state of stars. The star has puffed out its outer atmosphere. The ultraviolet light from the very hot core is illuminating that gas, and we're seeing fluorescence in that gas. Right, as technically speaking, not an H2 region, but what's in there is ionized hydrogen, and the light that we're seeing is recombination light, just like a normal H2 region. And Herschel was fundamental. So people had seen these fuzzy patches in the sky going back to Messier, right? M57 is a planetary nebula. What's really new for Herschel is he saw the dot at the center. And he realized that the dot at the center, which is pretty dim, tells you that this really has to be gas that we're looking at. Or this has to be some sort of monstrous star, right? Because obviously that star is different. If it's all stars, then that star is hugely different from all of the other stars that are making up the nebulosity. So the easiest explanation for that is that that dot is a star, and therefore everything else that we're seeing has to be way smaller than stars. It's got to be gas. And this thing obviously was associated with it because it was pretty much centered right in it. Right? If you saw a cloud like this and you saw a star over there, then it's not clear, right? This still could be a zillion stars that are far away, and this could just happen to be a neighboring star. But the fact that this star was nicely centered on this ring nebula said that it had to be associated with it. But obviously way different from whatever is making up the rest of the nebula. So we have holes. I guess I already explained that. That's where we would say there's dust, but there's an absence of stars, which was interpreted then as being an unusually close distance to the edge of the grindstone. Discovered Uranus. double stars. So you can see with your naked eye cases where we have two stars that are close together. Almost all of those cases are so-called optical binaries, right? Fake binaries. In order to actually show that there's a relationship between two stars, you have to follow them over the years and see that they're in fact orbiting around each other. So he actually was the first guy to do that and to show these orbits satisfied the rules of Newton. So everything seemed to be copacetic with these being just two stars that were in orbit around each other. Proper motion. So remember, proper motion is the change in the angular position of stars. And in some sense, it's easy to measure, right? All you have to do is have old data and fresh data and see that the right ascension of this star has changed by, 5 seconds in 50 years. But, it takes really being a professional in order to keep records for that sort of period of time. So here's the first guy who noticed the proper motion of stars. Again, probably no surprise. By this time, people are thinking that the stars are pretty much like the sun, and random motion, I think, would be expected. Laplace, nebular hypothesis. So this is one of these kind of funny bits in history, which is right and hurtful. So what Laplace was speculating on the origin of our solar system, and he quite naturally thought that our solar system had to start as something that was less dense. So the idea was that our solar system started as stuff that was in the process of accreting to a central protostar, and some of that stuff that was accreting made it into planets first, and so those planets ended up orbiting around the sun, right? So this is right? This is what we think is true today. But people saw things like this in the sky, where there seemed to be kind of a spiral pattern of stuff moving around other stuff. And they said, well, that's examples of that gas forming. So things like this had to be relatively close because they were just things like the sun, as opposed to being things like our galaxy. Right? So yes, spiral things go to form the solar system, but spiral things are also part of galaxies. So obviously none of that was, we can't blame that on Laplace. He has everything right. But there's going to be confusion about what these so-called spiral nebula are going to be about. Okay, so since the time of Copernicus, people were interested in measuring the parallax, right? So if the Earth is really moving, then as the Earth moves, the apparent position of the stars should shift. And that's what parallax is all about. And if the stars are even moderately close, if we move 200 million miles, as the Earth does, you might expect there to be some sort of change in position, right? Even if the stars are 1,000 million miles away. Well, unfortunately, the stars are way more than 1,000 million miles away. So as the Earth moves, the apparent position of the stars changes hardly at all. And it takes really precision work. So I would never claim to be able to measure parallax. It takes extraordinary efforts in order to measure these very small angles, given all the other things that are going to affect your equipment. Temperature is going to change how much your telescope bends, and that can affect your guess of how much the stars have moved. So in any case, Bessel and others at about the same time were the first people to actually measure the parallax of stars. So that's the first time we had actual distances to a star besides the sun. And actually, the distance to the sun at this time was not very well understood either, very well measured. Okay, so Parsons was a rich amateur who was the first guy to actually see that some of these objects that had been cataloged by Messier, if you looked at them with big telescopes, with dark-adapted eyes, they showed a spiral pattern. Right? So when you looked at those guys with binoculars, all you saw is fuzzy objects, right? Even for M31. Even through the telescope, at least with my eye, I don't see really spiral pattern. But apparently, if you have an even bigger telescope and you have a very dark sight, and of course, before electric lights, every place was very dark, you can detect that there's a spiral pattern in these guys. So I have no problems taking pictures of spiral nebula and seeing that there's a spiral pattern, but I can't say I've actually ever seen it looking through a telescope. So he's the first guy to do that. And you know, the natural connection was made to Laplace. Laplace had said, look for spiral things in the sky. Their solar system's in the process of formation. And Parsons says, look, I see spiral things in the sky. I bet those are solar systems in the process of formation, and therefore have to be pretty close because they're not hugely dim. And of course, it's exactly the reverse. Those things really contain 100 billion stars, so they're really quite bright. The only reason they look dim is they're hugely distant. Okay, Huggins. So if you start to get bigger and bigger telescopes, and we don't really have photography quite yet. So we do have daguerreotypes, but not astronomical photography useful yet. So you're still looking at these bands of colored light with your eye, and you can look at the spectra of stars, and you can see that they are different. And really probably the most striking difference you see is the difference between the spectra of a planetary nebula, which looks like the spectra of these fluorescent lights, right, a line spectra, and the spectra of most stars, which look like the incandescent light bulbs. So this is the start of looking at different types of stars. And the position of those lines, if it's not the same place it is in the lab, that tells you that the star is moving towards or away from you, so you can get Doppler shifts. And again, so planetary nebula are gas because they show a line spectra as opposed to a spectra that's similar to that of stars. So this is the first, well, I don't know where, so Herschel's evidence, I would say, is pretty good that planetary nebula are not unresolved stellar systems. But here we have Huggins being quite clear that they're in fact gas, and from the lines that you see, you can get the composition of those gas. Okay, so Henry Draper was a lawyer who died young, and he gave his fortune to making a star catalog because he was kind of interested as an amateur astronomer in the sky. So he financed Harvard to make this huge catalog of 100,000 stars, and they were the first. It was a huge project. It was bigger than any previous attempt to look at the spectral types of stars. It turns out that in the previous decades, people had looked at the spectra of lots of individual stars and had given them these funny letters. But this was the first huge attempt to measure the spectral types of 100,000 stars. And we know what they came up with. They came up with the OBA system that you're familiar with. The Henry Draper catalog itself didn't actually have the Roman numeral yet, but they had hints of luminosity class. It had been noted, and Cannon had noticed that some of these absorption lines were broad and some of them were narrow for the same sort of spectral type, but it hadn't actually been formalized yet into to the Roman numeral. Okay, so that brings us where we were about a century ago. So remember, parallax is hard to do. So even though this had been done now for a century, maybe we only had a parallax of 100 stars. And those are all going to be very, very nearby objects. Probably the 100 closest stars, or what people thought were the closest stars. Proper motion is a little bit easier to do. So we had a better statistical database of proper motion. And proper motion doesn't give you literally the distance, because something can have zero proper motion and not be very distant, just happen to be coming right towards the Earth or right away from the Earth. But generally speaking, if something has a small proper motion, it's probably pretty distant. And if something has a large proper motion, it's probably pretty close. So you can start to run statistical arguments on a much larger database than you can on just these 100 stars. We got spectral type from the Henry Draper catalog for 100,000 stars, for a big group of stars. Photographs are really just starting to come into play. People haven't figured out yet that the place to put your telescopes is above as much of the atmosphere as possible. So we still have telescopes like the Great Refractor that's in Wisconsin which is a 40-inch refracting telescope built a little bit after 1900, which is good, but not great, right? Because you have hugely worse resolution when you're under the ocean of air than if you can get above it. But people are soon going to start building mountaintop telescopes. We got, at this point, lots of catalogs of objects. In particular, the Henry Draper catalog. We have Messier's catalog. There's a successor catalog of nebula that's called the New General Catalog, NGC numbers. So we've got a lot of, we don't have to look randomly in the sky. We have a list of objects that are of interest. The HR diagram is about to be discovered. And so, of course, the HR diagram includes the idea of a difference between giant stars and dwarf stars on the main sequence. And we talked about spectral parallax. Once you know what the main sequence is about, then you can measure distances using the spectral type. It's not a real accurate distance because there's a finite thickness to the main sequence, but it's better than nothing. And we also have main sequence fitting for clusters, which gives you a much more precise sort of distance. Okay, so that's kind of the backdrop for, so around 1900, if people asked what the universe was like, they would have more or less what Newton had said 300 years earlier, that the universe is probably mostly a random arrangement of stars that maybe goes out to infinity, maybe not, maybe it has just a finite collection of them, but they would have a very limited idea about the structure of the universe as a whole. So we've got these four research groups that are going to, in the end, say useful stuff about the shape and size of our galaxy. So stargazing, that's kind of the continuation of what Herschel had done, which was kind of contained in what Kant had said. We're just going to do it more precise to figure out what the shape and structure of our galaxy is by counting the number of stars in lots of different directions. Globular clusters a priori don't seem to have a lot of connection to our galaxy. Right? They're unusual objects, though, that are very different from open clusters. And so people were out to study those things, too. And it turns out that globular clusters are going to provide great evidence for the size and structure of our galaxy. These so-called spiral nebula at the time, which probably most people thought were planetary systems in formation, those are obviously worth looking at too. So these are people who are looking at the spiral nebula and trying to understand what they're about. And here we have what seems to me to be the dullest possible research path that doesn't look like, to me like it's going to discover anything useful, but in the end it actually is going to discover everything. And what these guys are doing is just looking in detail at the motion of nearby stars. And remember that the stars that you can see are just, you know, very small piece of our galaxy. So it's kind of surprising that by looking at this little piece, you can kind of understand the whole piece. And I'm sure the people who are doing this had no idea at the start that what they were doing was going to lead any give any hints about what the overall structure of the universe was like. Okay, so let's take a look at these options. So star gazing, we've already described. All you have to do is aim your telescope in lots of different directions and count the number of stars. So Kapteyn was, I think, a Dutch astronomer. Did this with really pretty good precision, and he came up with an idea of the approximate size and shape of our galaxy, which is pretty much what you would get if you just by eye if you look at this picture. There are pretty much the same number of stars in this direction as there are in the other direction, so you come to the conclusion that the Earth is at least somewhat close to the center, and it's got to be relatively thin. So the particular dimensions that he came up with were about 10 kiloparsecs. So according to our book, it's more like 50 kiloparsecs. So he's missing a big piece of the diameter. And he came up with 2 kiloparsecs as the thickness of the disk. And that's not a bad number. So I said 1,000 light years, which is actually a sixth of that distance. But remember that there are different distances that you could be measured. So he's got the thickness about right. He's way off on the diameter. And of course, you know, the reason for this is the dust, right? You can't see very far. So it looks like the stars are thinning out, but all that's really happening is that the dust is getting in the way and you're not seeing the stars that are really there. So stargazing would work if space were transparent, but it's not. You're automatically limited, like you're in a cloud, to seeing a certain distance, and that's really what he's measured here, is how far you can see with a telescope. So he redid this whole study 20 years later, and he came, you know, it's the same story, right? Nothing really particularly different. Sun still seems to be not literally in the center, because things are a little bit thicker in the direction of Sagittarius than they are in the direction of Orion. So the sun isn't literally at the center, but it's, I think it's within 20% of the center of this grindstone. Okay, let's jump over here to spirals. So this is the start of what's, well, maybe I'm jumping a little bit ahead. So what Silfer did is he looked at the behavior of these spiral nebulas. And there's a huge hint in what he reported, and that was that the spiral nebula seemed to have much larger Doppler shifts than typical stars. So Andromeda turns out to be moving towards us, but with that exception, we'll find out that mostly objects have red shifts, but the most important fact is they're moving hugely fast. And unless we're really wrong about our galaxy, it should have been recognized that those were more than the escape velocity of our galaxy. So it's hard to see that something that's moving that fast and would escape our galaxy could currently be associated with our galaxy. He also claimed, and this is true but false, he also claimed he saw the spiral galaxies change in rotation. So remember I said that this pattern takes hundreds of millions of years to change. So if you look at the oldest available picture of M101 and you look at the newest available picture of M101, it's going to have changed, you know, a part in a million. It's not going to have changed noticeably. But he thought he saw changes in the orientation of these guys in the right direction. That is to say, he thought that they were turning that way. We call that the winding direction. But the real problem comes with Van Maan's further observations. And to this day, we haven't really figured out what went wrong with Van Maan. So what Van Maan did is he looked at old and new pictures of, for example, M101, and he measured in detail how the dots that make up this galaxy seem to change with time. And what he claimed to measure is the things were rotating that way, and rotating what we would call relatively fast. That is to say, you can't go faster than the speed of light. So if something is big and the outside can't rotate faster than the speed of light, then the thing has to itself rotate what you would call relatively slow. If you see something spinning revolutions per year, it automatically has to be smaller than a light year in radius. So by measuring relatively fast motion, automatically these things had to be relatively small. They couldn't be co-equal with our galaxy. And all of that is wrong. Right? They're not winding, and even if they're not unwinding, and even if they were unwinding, it'd be too small to measure. So some sort of systematic error entered into what he was doing, and people have tried to write papers. We actually have the equipment. So he's not a bad astronomer. We actually have the equipment he used to make these measurements, and people have tried to remeasure them. But this published result is going to change, change at least the history of the discussion. So at the same time, Ricciardi, who ended up having kind of a check, so Van Maan is, well, not sure how what the right way to describe this. All of these guys are today respected astronomers, but of these two, Ricciardi is the lead. At the time, Ricciardi would have been kind of the dark sheep of the group, and therefore his observations probably aren't going to be weighed as heavily. So he saw bright objects in some of these distant objects. So just as today we see a previously unidentified spot in M101 suddenly brighten and get bright enough to be seen in binoculars, Ricciardi had noticed similar things in other galaxies, and he had made an identification of them with novas. So at the time, the distinction between supernovas and novas was not made, right? So novas, you remember, are material being dumped on a white dwarf, which explodes, and it can happen repetitively, while it's very bright, it's not nearly as bright as a supernova, which leads to the total disruption of the star. So he called these things nova, which just means new star. So these were sudden brightenings in these distant elliptical nebula, and he made the association of them with our nova, and he came to the conclusion that those guys had to be far away. And in fact, they're way farther than he thought, because the things that he thought were novas were really supernovas. So let's kind of not go to the end story there and continue on with all of these other, in essence, false leads. Globular clusters. So Henrietta Leavitt was in this group of Harvard astronomers, and her job was to look at the pictures from the Magellanic Clouds. So the Magellanic Clouds are fuzzy areas in the sky that we can't see. They're only visible in the southern hemisphere. And there are lots of stars there. Famously, in 1987, that's where supernova 1987 exploded, in the Magellanic Clouds nearby our galaxy. So approximately speaking, the Magellanic Clouds are kind of like there. They're outside of the immediate vicinity of our galaxy, but they are associated with our galaxy. And what Henrietta Leavitt found is there was a relationship between the period and the apparent magnitude of these stars. Now, remember, that's very important, is we now have a relationship between the period and the absolute magnitude of those stars. But in order to figure out what the absolute magnitude was of these stars, she needed to know the distance to the Magellanic Clouds, and that was at the time unknown. So somebody had to calibrate the period apparent magnitude relationship that Henrietta Leavitt came up with in order to convert it to a period absolute magnitude relationship that we could use to find distances. So you need one distance in order to calculate lots of distances. You need to calibrate the relationship between period and luminosity. And she was interested in doing that, but she was prevented by her boss from following up on that. So Hertzsprung and Russell, right? Same guys as Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. Russell is sometimes called the Dean of American Astronomers. So he was kind of the first great American astronomer, centered at Princeton. Although, you know, maybe the other thing that's worth emphasizing is that Russell was more of a theoretical astronomer than you can guess. Princeton is not a good site to observe from. And at this date and time, you know, you couldn't jump on a plane and go to the West Coast to go to an observatory. So the people who were observers really lived at the observatory, and the people who were theorists really lived in, at Harvard and Princeton and places like that. And they would just work from photographs if they did anything else. Okay, so this is the first attempt to calibrate the period luminosity relationship of Cepheids. And they got a distance to the Magellanic Clouds that was about 10 kiloparsecs. And this is wrong by about a factor of 5. More like 50 kiloparsecs is the right answer. So how did these two very famous astronomers go wrong? Well, you have to know the distance to a Cepheid variable in order to figure out what the absolute magnitude is. So Henrietta Leavitt had an advantage. She had, approximately speaking, a whole small galaxy of Cepheid variables that she could look at, all that were pretty much the same distance from the Earth. And so the apparent magnitude of variation told you that there had to be some relationship. But she had no idea where the Magellanic Cloud was, what its distance was. So we needed to find a Cepheid variable whose distance we could calculate. There is no Cepheid variable even today whose distance you can get by trigonometric parallax. They're all relatively they're relatively rare supergiant stars, generally speaking, and so there just aren't any close, right? They're not main sequence stars, right? Main sequence, so here's where the Cepheid variables are. They're well off the main sequence, and therefore they're guaranteed to be relatively rare stars. Okay, so we need something beyond trigonometric parallax to get this distance. Open clusters, right? So we have a way of getting distance to open clusters, and some of these stars, particularly the brightest ones, can be fairly young objects. So you can look for them in open clusters. No Cepheid variables then known in an open cluster. We now know of one Cepheid variable in an open cluster, but that's a relatively recent phenomena. So can't use main sequence fitting. So what's left? Right? So you might look at this list of methods, and all of those are modern methods. None of them were available. So the only method we had was proper motion. So remember, proper motion doesn't give you the distance. It gives you kind of a statistical estimate of what the distance was. So there were 6 Cepheid variable stars that had proper motion data. And just turned out by, kind of random chance that the average wasn't the right answer. The average was not the true mean because of statistical fluctuation. So we've got a way of getting distances, but the calibration is all off, and it's going to give us distances that are wrong by about a factor of 5. Okay, so Shapley. So again, using Cepheid variable stars and also using kind of a substitute idea, which we're going to see in a couple of ways. So if you don't have any good things to do, you have to try things that you know are bad ideas also. And one bad idea you can have is assume that things are all the same, right? That people are all the same size or something like that. And so that's what we're going to see in a couple of cases, people assuming that something is pretty much the same size. And it's probably maybe true on average. The average size of things may be the same, but not for individuals. And the assumption that they made here is that the size of globular clusters was pretty much a constant. So if a globular cluster seemed to be small, it had to be very distant. And incidentally, you see here at the bottom, Trumpler doing the same thing with open clusters. So these are not great. I'm sure the people who did this knew that these were not great assumptions, that things really do have different sizes, but probably not hugely different sizes. So probably it's not going to make a huge sort of error. At least that's the hope. Okay, so he came up with distances that were 60 kiloparsecs to globular clusters, and that's about right. And the diameter of the Milky Way of about 100 kiloparsecs. And our book says about 50 kiloparsecs. So these are better numbers, but they're not great numbers yet. And before we quit, let me just comment on what's on the back of this sheet. So on the back of this sheet, we have the 1920 Great Debate. So Shapley and Curtis are famously going to arrive in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and they're going to have a discussion, public discussion, with the National Academy of Sciences on the shape and size of our galaxy. So what we have here are the arguments they made in their lecture about the shape and size of our galaxy, and kind of no surprise, they're both wrong in detail, right? And you can pick which one is the most right. But it really took another 10 years to figure out what was going on.